Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of Roaring Metropolis, Businessmen's Campaign for a Civic Welfare State. The book is published by Penn Press this year, and the author is Daniel Amsterdam. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Pleasure to have you on. Pleasure to have read the book. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself before we get into our conversation about the book?
Okay, I'm a historian by training. I'm currently an assistant professor in the School of History and Sociology at Georgia Tech. I study primarily the history of cities, social policy, and inequality across the 20th century. Before coming to Georgia Tech, I was on the faculty at Ohio State for a little bit and did my graduate work at the University of Pennsylvania.
Super. It's such an interesting topic, and I think your way into this is so interesting. Your argument seems to be, at least at the start, that during the early part of the 20th century, urban power brokers were not local business owners. If these were not the central players in how cities were run, who is in charge of cities like Atlanta and Detroit and Philadelphia before the time period that you study?
So that's right. I mean, in the early 20th century, really in the from the turn of the 20th century through World War I, wealthy business people were major players in local politics, as I describe in the book, before getting to the kind of thrust of my story in the 1920s, when I find that business people especially had a great deal of power and influence over urban politics, especially in comparison to this earlier pre-World War I period. Sort of the answer to your question is that it's complicated, and it differed by city. For instance, in Philadelphia, there was a real slice of the business community that was very powerful. These were utility moguls like Peter Widener, William Elkins, who were very, very connected to the notoriously corrupt political machine in Philadelphia, and they were able to wield a significant amount of power in the early 20th century, although the kind of dynamics surrounding machine politics and the controversy surrounding machine politics often stymied what they were trying to do. And in part, that was because a not necessarily as wealthy, but also very prominent and even larger subset of the business community in Philadelphia was really opposed to machine rule. So there was this kind of division within the business elite in the early decades of the 20th century that made it hard for business people to get what they wanted out of local government. So taking Philadelphia as a continuing example, however, by the 1920s, business people's frustration with government inaction due to this gridlock that I just described, based in controversies around machine rule, business people across the board had just gotten really frustrated with that, and they had, come to sort of prioritize getting their policy goals done, which included a very, very aggressive attempt to push government to spend on a wide variety of social policies. They started to prioritize that and accomplishing that over settling questions of political process and questions of purity in local politics. And so that slice of the business elite that was opposed to the political machine increasingly makes peace with machine tactics. And you see the business elite sort of consolidating behind machine rule, which helps to unleash what is a truly unprecedented surge in social spending and public spending more generally in Philadelphia. So that's just one example.
So we don't get too far into your story. We lay a little bit more of the groundwork. Because I think each one of these cases is so interesting. But just to kind of get some of the more foundation here set, much of your book is about how those with money gained influence, additional influence, through organizations. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what some of the types of organizations that arise during this time period to represent the businessmen that are in your subtitle.
That's a great question. Chambers of commerce are a leading source of organizational power as time moves on throughout the period. Also, employers associations, which are really anti-union associations for the most part. And sometimes when business groups, or individual business people especially, wanted to kind of influence an agenda on their own or with particular allies, they would form their own political groups. Kind of the best example of this was in Detroit, one of the three main cities that I studied, Philadelphia being one, Atlanta being another, and Detroit being the third that I study most intensively. The president of Cadillac, Henry Leland, founds this organization, the Detroit Citizens League, which originally wants to kind of revamp the city charter, the basic structure of elections, to try to increase elite influence in city politics. And then he gets into all sorts of other things. And from forming his own organization, he starts to build alliances across the increasingly coherent business class in Detroit during the early 20th century.
Now, as you just mentioned, you focus on these three cities. Why these three? This doesn't include New York. This doesn't include Chicago. Some of the cities that doesn't include Boston. What's going on in these three cities during the 1920s that is so significant?
Well, really, it has to do with my being interested in a question that has been so fundamental to political science and sociology, this question of, to modify it to a degree, how and to what degree did the ruling class, meaning the business elite, rule? And so I wanted to trace corporate politics really across three very different political cities, very different political regimes. Philadelphia being sort of the quintessentially machine-dominated city in the early 20th century. Detroit was a city that had some machine politics or something similar, but by the 1920s, had become kind of a poster child of reform politics, in part because of Henry Leland, who I just mentioned, ability to organize business people to rewrite the city charter. And then Atlanta serves then as an example of the city of widespread disfranchisement. And at the same time, though, in addition to those kind of representing essential political regimes of the early 20th century, those cities also allow me to explore how businessmen's political activism interacted with the activism of other groups, including middle-class women's associations, organized labor, African-American immigrant activists, and even the Ku Klux Klan.
So into the 1920s, business elites seek out this new type of power, but it wasn't always to advance sort of a crude bottom line. What was on the policy agenda of these business organizations in these cities? What did they care about, and what did they care about that maybe is surprising?
Okay, that's a great question. What I focus on in the book is issues of social policy and social spending. And what I find is that business people organized around certain social policies with a high degree of commonality across places. And these included social policies like public education, building parks, city planning, building playgrounds across the city at a time when playgrounds were different than they are today. I mean, they were really places where public employees supervised children's play in a way that would be totally unfamiliar to us today. I mean, picture kind of a drop-off gym class. You know, they were also very focused on building decentralized cities, on alleviating residential congestion. So they were interested in social policies that did certain things. And this was even though they were pretty famously opposed to the rise of what we call the social welfare state, sort of the collection of social policies we identify usually with the New Deal. So the implementation of unemployment compensation, public pensions for the elderly, a federal minimum wage, maximum wage hours laws, the social welfare state being kind of a collection of policies that controlled how employers could treat their employees, determined how much employers had to pay their employees, sort of intervened in the labor market to limit employers' power and to limit the possible exploitation of workers. Most employers weren't really into that. They wanted to control wages. They wanted to control their own firms. But nonetheless, they favored different social policies, again, such as schools, parks, playgrounds, also building museums, libraries. A collection of programs that I call the civic welfare state. And I call it that for two reasons. One, because business people were very concerned about the social conditions and the political conditions of cities at that time. And they were particularly focused on promoting social policies and, again, government-sponsored, local government social policies that could further a particular vision of citizenship. And at the same time, business people came to believe, and especially in sort of more up-and-coming cities like Atlanta, that these kinds of programs were things that business people wanted. And so at the same time as they were focused on citizenship, they were also focused on kind of the well-being, of economic well-being of cities themselves. So civic and civic welfare state has this double meaning. And yeah, I mean, it certainly was in some ways crassly about, you know, profit, right? But these business people also existed in local democracies, and they were very concerned in finding ways to make those democracies friendly to their interests and to capitalism more generally. So it would be overly reductive to merely say that it was about, you know, just kind of profit at the end of the day.
Now, were they alone on these issues? Who are some of the groups that they form common cause with, and who is their greatest opposition? You mentioned a couple at the beginning of our conversation, but who is opposing some of these moves for a civic welfare state?
Well, you know, they have there were many activists in the early 20th century that favored these sorts of programs, right? Famously, these are kind of at the core in some ways of what we call the progressive agenda in the early 20th century. Business people were sort of different in some ways than some of the most quintessential and famous progressives like John Dewey, Jane Addams, et cetera, because these business people really thought that these programs were both necessary and sufficient for building good cities, whereas, you know, a reformer like Jane Addams, John Dewey, Florence Kelly, et cetera, you know, they thought that there needed to be, over time especially, their thinking evolved into focusing more on the development of a robust social safety net that really tried to prevent economic insecurity in a larger scale than, and certainly in ways that business people largely rejected. So in a sense, you know, they had common cause, and in some ways their agenda was not always controversial, yet they were able to maneuver in a way so that it was often business interests, allies of business interests, who were able to control spending, to shape its particular form, to give particular content to the programs that business people especially wanted to see. And then in terms of their opposition, again, it really it's in flux in different cities. And in some ways, you know, it was more the not necessarily the basic content of their agenda that caused opposition. It was that it was about their desire to control. And in this regard, they often, of course, ran into opposition from organized labor. Also, immigrant groups were sometimes opposed to kind of this very quote unquote Americanizing thrust of a lot of the programs that business people wanted to see implemented. And then every now and again in cities, you kind of see these homeowners associations rise and object to kind of the rising cost of some of these programs. That happens in Detroit, for instance, which prevents what I think is, in retrospect, a surprising goal of the business elite in Detroit, which was to build a big subway system, even though this was a famously automobile-friendly city. But business interests are not able to do that because homeowners just really don't want to foot the bill. So again, what I try to show is that whether it's opposition, support, alliances, et cetera, there's a lot of context that really matters here. And a lot of contingency to this story.
Now, you just note one of the policy failures in Detroit. I wonder if there's a notable success story that sort of tells the story from one of these cities of something that maybe even we sort of still have with us that can be attributed to the politics and sort of the political influence during this time period of the businessman's campaign. Does something stand out from you from one of these, really interesting cities?
A lot of landmarks from the early 20th century that we still have with us today are deeply connected to this story. Maybe most recognizably because of the movie Rocky is the Art Museum in Philadelphia that, Sylvester Stallone's character runs up the steps of and jumps on top of. That is a pure product of the politics that I am describing. The entire Benjamin Franklin Parkway that Sylvester Stallone runs down is also a product of that. In Detroit, the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is now home to those fantastic murals by Diego Rivera, was part of this agenda. And so was the Detroit Public Library across the street there. A lot of City Beautiful style planning comes from this. If you were to drive around a city like Detroit or Philadelphia and Atlanta to some degree, you would notice that there were, many incredibly expensive, large, elaborate, monumental high schools built during this time period, for instance, that were deeply attached to this social policy agenda as well. The effects were really durable in many ways.
Yeah, the book is just so interesting. The title, again, is Roaring Metropolis, Businessman's Campaign for a Civic Welfare State, published by Penn Press in 2016. Daniel Amsterdam, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.